TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Tariq Ali on Religious Fundamentalism. Tariq Ali is an atheist who grew up around Muslims in Pakistan. He's a world-renowned scholar on the history and culture of Islam. After arriving as a student at Oxford in 1963, he became one of the leaders of the movement against the U.S. war on Vietnam. As time passed, he became increasingly critical of American and Israeli foreign policies and emerged as the internationally respected critic. Tariq Ali is a regular contributor to the BBC, The Guardian, and the London Review of Books. He's editor and board member of the New Left Review. Tariq Ali is also a very prolific writer. His fiction includes a series of historical novels about Islam, Shadows of the Pomegranate Tree, A Sultan in Palermo, and The Stone Woman. His nonfiction includes the just-reissued Street Fighting Years, an autobiography of the 60s, and Speaking of Empire and Resistance, Conversations with David Barsamyan. His book Bush in Babylon attacks the invasion of Iraq by the Bush administration. Here's part two of an hour-long talk by Tariq Ali, recorded in April 2005 in Berkeley. He begins with memories of the Islamic history of Palermo and Sicily.
When I was writing this novel on Sicily, A Sultan in Palermo, this is now a book set in 12th century Sicily, at a time when it was no longer an island ruled by Muslims, but they had ruled it for nearly 250 years. The Normans had taken over two islands at roughly the same time. In 1066, they took an island called... Yes, that's right, you know it, and now called Britain. And a few years later, they took Sicily. And Palermo was one of the jewels of the Mediterranean world. An incredibly large city, one of the big cities of the world, together with Baghdad and Cordoba in Spain, and a center of trade and culture. And when the Normans took it over, they found such a high form of civilization that they preserved Arabic as the language of learning. And the Norman kings themselves used to dress in Arab clothes. All their advisors were Arabic. Their children were taught Arabic. Arabic became the language, remained the language. And they used to mock their Norman cousins who had the misfortune to capture this cold, cloudy island where there was permanent darkness. A great deal has been written and spoken about Islamic fundamentalism, Islamic extremism, some of it which one can agree with, quite a lot of it greatly exaggerated. But it's not simply the case that the rise of religious extremism is confined to the Islamic world, is it? Look at the United States of America. I mean, who would have thought 30 years ago that the Christian right in this country would have such a stranglehold on mainstream U.S. politics, not just the Republicans, but even Democrats who should know better, pandering to some of these people? Who would have thought that? So this rise of religion in this neoliberal world is a phenomenon which affects the whole world. I mean, I was shocked, to put it bluntly, at the enormous coverage given to the funeral of the Pope. I mean, not just in the United States. I mean, you compare that. I remember, I'm old enough to remember when the last Pope died. And I think I'll be around when this one does too. But I remember when the last Pope died. It was reported, and you know, there were sort of decent obits in the press, but on this scale, flags flying at half-mast, the entire Western European and European and American media was no different from this. The BBC had saturation coverage for 3 days. No, the Pope is still alive. No, he's not dead. There's a vigil at his bedside. For heaven's sake, if you'll pardon the expression, let the guy die in peace. And then a new Pope is elected, who, it turns out, was a Nazi in his youth. And then they fall over each other to apologize for this and justify it, saying, oh, well, he was only 17. 17 seems quite old to me, you know. And it was mandatory. This is the phrase you will see in lots of the press. It wasn't mandatory. Many young Germans of that age did not join the Hitler Youth. They were forcibly recruited into the army. That I can understand. But they were not obliged or forced at gunpoint to join the Hitler Youth. In Bavaria, lots of them did because they were sympathetic to fascism, as clearly was Benedictus, if we call him by his new name. So young Benedictus joined the Hitler Youth. So we now have an extremely right-wing Pope. Of course he's not a fascist any longer. Who is? All the Italian fascists in Berlusconi's government, if you ask them, are you still fascist? They say, no, we are post-fascists. Of course, Mussolini did a lot of good things, which you can't deny, and he wasn't really anti-Semitic. He was just helping the Germans out. So this cover-up, which is constantly being carried out because these people are now close allies of the West, is shocking, actually. It really is. And basically what both this guy, Ratzinger, and the previous Pope did, they belong to the most extreme right-wing currents within the Catholic Church, Opus Dei, which backed them. They then appointed 50 cardinals. These cardinals then ensured that the guy, the Grand Inquisitor, then became the Pope. And the Grand Inquisitor was responsible for hunting out liberation theologists in Latin America who were genuinely helping the poor in Brazil, in Argentina, in Mexico, working with the poor to help them, finding them food, helping them in land struggles. All this was going on. They've been booted out. When the AIDS epidemic reached, you know, horrific proportions, these guys refused. They said no good Catholic will use contraceptives. I mean, they attacked the very notion of that. So they actually have the deaths of many people at their door. It's not just a joke. This is taken seriously by some people. So the point I'm making is that you have extremism in all religions. It's not simply isolated to the Muslim world. And I want to give you two images of something about, I think it was a year and a half or 2 years ago. There were two trials taking place. Within weeks of each other, there was a trial taking place of an Islamic extremist in Indonesia who had been responsible and had admitted responsibility for bombing the Australian tourists, you will recall, who were killed in Bali. His trial was taking place. He came into the courtroom. He smiled at his supporters. He looked up at heaven, exchanged a few smiles with the Creator, and ignored the court ruling, which sentenced him to death. He was happy. He was smiling, totally oblivious to the real world. He had done his duty. He believed he had obeyed the commandments of God. And he said, fine, he was led away. I don't know whether he's been executed or whether it's been delayed. I didn't follow that particular thing beyond that. But what I did notice in exactly the same week or within 10 days of that, the trial in the United States of a guy who had killed a doctor, shot a doctor performing abortions, and had participated in organizing the bombing of abortion clinics. And I promise you, his body language was exactly the same. When he came into court, he stood at the dock, he waved to, you know, his supporters in the court. He too looked up. He ignored the judge, I mean, sort of regarding him as beyond contempt. He didn't deny what he had done. Just like the Indonesian Muslim, didn't deny what he had done, and he too was sentenced. So there is a similarity here between religious extremists of various hues, that once you reach that level of isolation from reality, you are capable of doing virtually anything. Blind faith, which is what this is, and not reasoned faith, but totally blind faith, can lead you to justify anything if you become literalists, saying this is forbidden by the Old Testament or the New Testament or the Quran. If you become literalists, you are capable of doing anything. And the fact is that instead of combating this in the name of secular and democratic values, the politicians find it difficult to really confront this head on. That, I think, is dangerous in the United States. As you know, that the big difference between this country and Europe is you have very widespread religious beliefs here. The bulk of the population, I think the figure is 90%, believes in the deity. 70% believe in angels, which is at least, it has a certain charm about it. Since, you know, it's sort of, one can have, think surreal thoughts about angels. And 60% believe in the devil. And as the great German writer Goethe once said, if you believe in the devil, it means you're already in his grip. But these are the official figures given when the statistics are published. I'm convinced that in the Islamic world, the figure would be much lower if people weren't worried about getting into trouble. Much, much lower. In Europe, it's, you know, totally different on that level. So the fact that the world's largest empire is also the world's largest religious state, in that sense of the word, is quite alarming. And the fact that democratic politicians seem to be incapable of combating this is extremely worrying. When they thought that the reason Bush had won the last election was because of gay marriages and the Christian right, which I think is partially the case, but I think the main reason he won is because he succeeded in pushing his security agenda and frightening large numbers of people and creating an atmosphere of fear, and the Democrats were incapable of challenging that in any serious way. So the Democratic attack on Bush came saying, he's not fighting the war as it should be fought, we would have fought it better. And when you say that to the population, they say, better the devil we know. We're in a mess, he created the mess, maybe he can pull us out of it, rather than new people taking over the mess and making it worse, and they don't even know what's going on properly. Nonetheless, certainly religious values played a part in it, and you now notice that people are beginning to take this very seriously inside the democratic establishment. And I think that that could really be fatal for U.S. politics. But it certainly does not behove the current day leaders of the United States to give lectures to the Islamic world on all this. I mean, just think about it. In fact, you know, lots of hardcore religious preachers would agree with Bush on his religious beliefs. There is an agreement across faiths on some of these things. And many people in these worlds are trying to fight for a genuine modernity, a genuine modernization. So that is a theme which is covered in all my books. And one last word about my novels. When I first started writing the Islam Quintet, it was soon after the Gulf War. And basically, in these novels, I wanted to broach the question of why Islam, of all the three big religions, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, that Islam alone had not modernized, had seen no reformation in its ranks. And that led me to ask the question, why? Simple question. And I reached the conclusion that one reason this course had been disrupted within Islam and Islamic culture was because of what had happened in Spain in the 15th century. When the reconquest of Spain, the Inquisition, had crushed and defeated Islamic civilization, and with it the Jews, who were very close to and very dependent on that civilization, and expelled them from Spain as they were expelled from Sicily. And Europe, the new European identity, was formed essentially as a monolithic identity. Europe had to be Christian. No Muslims were to be allowed in it. That affected, in my view, both the future of Europe and the future of Islam. And this is the theme I couldn't explore totally historically, because one had to re-evoke that world. And that is a world, the clashes between Western Christendom and Islamic civilization, that I evoke in the Islamic Quintet, of which Sultan in Palermo is the fourth. There's one more novel to go, which will be has to be set in the modern period, the last years of the 20th and the first years of the 21st century. So when I finally get time, I mean, I would have finished it all had it not been for your president, who distracted me into writing two other books. But I am now trying to finish them off. And when the last book is written, I think you will find many familiar figures in it. That much I can promise you. Thank you.
You are listening to Tariq Ali, Islamic scholar and anti-war activist. He spoke at an event for Cody's Books in Berkeley in April of 2005. Tariq Ali stayed for an extensive question and answer period. The first question came from a woman seated next to me. She asked, "How has Islamic fundamentalism been increased, and does it also have to do with the absence of a welfare state and people turning to religious organizations as a result?"
The big increase in some of these hardcore fundamentalist groups came in the last years of the last two decades of the Cold War. And the reason these groups were created was because the countries like Pakistan and Saudi Arabia and Egypt were asked by the United States to provide these hardcore groups to go and fight the jihad against the Russians in Afghanistan. Don't forget. And I know that memories are short, but do try and dig out the photographs of Ronald Reagan in the White House surrounded with the leaders of these jihadi groups, you know, standing on either side of him, people who actually committed a lot of crimes in Afghanistan and who are largely responsible for the creation of Al-Qaeda. Reagan had them on either side of him, and he introduced them to the press corps with the unforgettable words, "These people are the equivalent for their countries of our founding fathers." What Jefferson or Washington would have made of these guys, I don't know. But nonetheless, that's what Reagan said. And Mrs. Thatcher said the same thing. Robert Fisk has reported how when he was a reporter for the Times of London, and he wanted to report on some of the atrocities carried out by these groups, including one of them in which Osama bin Laden was involved, bombing a co-educational school and destroying it and executing the head teachers, he was told by the British Foreign Office, you have to refer to these people as freedom fighters, not terrorists. Okay? So the responsibility of the United States in helping the establishment of these groups should never be underestimated. The second point is, in a more recent period, in a neoliberal world, when Social Security is being rolled back in this country now, but it has already been rolled back in many other parts of the world under IMF and World Bank rules, where everything is privatized, basically. And so the safety net which these states used to provide doesn't exist. And in Egypt and in Pakistan, many of the Islamist groups, who are not extremist in that sense, but Islamist groups, actually go into the communities with doctors, with clinics, and provide free health, free medicines. Naturally, people turn to them. It's not a big surprise. And these groups, I would say, though they are Islamist, are the equivalent of Christian democratic parties in Western Europe. One may not agree with them, I don't, but you have to understand that they are legitimate organizations, and preventing them, as they do in Egypt, from sharing power is foolish, because it just creates problems. But the reason they have grown in size is because the state has ceased to do what it's doing, so people turn to them. It's like many people in Latin America turn to the liberation theologists. You know, it has certain similarities.
A little later, a surprisingly hostile question came from a man in the back row. He said to Tariq Ali that he would have been laughed off the stage anywhere but in Berkeley had he drawn parallels between Islam and Christian fundamentalism, with Islam's third-class status for women, suicide bombs, and the sentencing of homosexuals to death. Here's Tariq Ali's answer.
Now, the fact that in many Muslim countries, not in all, I have to say, it certainly isn't the case in Indonesia, for instance, that which is the largest and most populous Islamic state in the world, that homosexuals are either imprisoned or shot. In fact, just 6 months ago, the Indonesian censors passed the first gay movie made in Indonesia, which shows an Indonesian architect coming out and actually shows gay kissing on the screen. So the diversity of the Muslim world is often ignored because Saudi Arabia is taken as the stereotypical example. Or Iran, and even Iran of 5 or 6 years ago. And I would say that this is not the case in most of the Islamic world, A. Secondly, I mean, I will give you just one example in the realm of culture, okay? If you now look at, for the last 10 years, what Iranian culture, not the clerics, but what Iranian culture is producing in the shape of auteur cinema, this Iranian new wave has no equivalent in the West today. And if I would just urge you to just go and see some of these Iranian movies and then compare them to the bilge which is turned out by Hollywood. Yeah, but the bulk of Iranian filmmakers are not in jail. They're making films. These films are being shown. And some of these films, of which one of the latest ones is called The Lizard, actually satirize the mullahs. And I'm just not talking about, I'm just saying if you look at the quality of these films and compare them to what your culture is producing week after week, there's no comparison. The Islamic world is far more diverse and broader than the stereotypes which are shown. Of course women are oppressed in Saudi Arabia. Of course women are forced to wear the hijab in Iran, and people fight against that. In Saudi Arabia they can't fight because for the last 50 to 60 years, first the British Empire and then your own country has done a deal with the Saudi royal family and the Wahhabi clerics who surround it to not permit any change there. So there is no change. happening in Saudi Arabia, but all over the rest of the Muslim world, there are very, very different forces, both within in Pakistan. You had a very dynamic women's movement, which opposed the laws put through by General Zia, one of the most favored dictators of the United States, who actually helped to create the fundamentalist groups who then wrought havoc in Pakistan itself. That's the reality. So it's pointless getting away from that. Secular radical forces have suffered a massive defeat in the end of the 90s, have virtually been wiped out as a serious force, and many of those who were in that direction have become apologists for the American empire. So you're caught, in a sense, between some of these groups and apologists for the U.S. empire. And this is why I argue always that one has to create a genuine third way, which is both anti-imperialist and secular. And it's not easy, but some of these people do exist in Iraq. It is not the case that the entire resistance is either Zarqawi or religious groups. There are many other people who are fighting back because their country is occupied. They're not people I would necessarily agree with, but on the other hand, I do support their right to resist to try and free their country. We've had this case often in the days of the British Empire in the Sudan. In the last years of the 19th century, there's no progressive group fighting them. In Libya, against the Italian colonization, you had a war which went on from 1911 to 1932, a long, drawn-out guerrilla war waged largely by people who considered themselves Muslims. But they didn't like their country being occupied. And one can't, especially if you belong to this country and are a citizen of it, impose conditions on the resistance. We will only support you if you agree with us. It's crazy.
That was Tariq Ali's answer to a man who said it was beyond the pale to compare Christian and Islamic fundamentalism. You can find out more about the work of Tariq Ali on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information how to order a copy of the complete one-hour talk by Tariq Ali by calling us. That recording includes part one, Ideas for Movement Against the Wars in the Middle East. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your tape or CD order is the only support we receive and helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.